Coming up on today's show,
never be afraid to put on a resume what you've done. I've done everything from, I've been a glazer working for my friend's father as a glass cutter. I've been a dog groomer. I've worked on oil burners, and it's gotten me jobs.
Welcome to another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment, featuring interviews with guests who are having success in entertainment, primarily music. I am Bruce Wozniak, talking to guests who are singers, songwriters, musicians, recording artists, and more from the worldwide music community. Get in touch with me by writing to podcast@nhte.net, or instead of email, you can DM me through the @NowHearThisEntertainment Instagram account. Joining me today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line from New York City, my guest has made a career of 40-plus years in music on the non-performer side of the glass. His time in recording studios has included sessions involving some of the biggest names in music, from Billy Joel to John Lennon to Frank Sinatra. He built and designed a recording studio in Manhattan that he ended up owning, with an office inside there being home to the personal management company for the legendary Keith Richards. Another studio that he built was included in a cover story that Mix Magazine did on the 10 best studios built in the world at the time. Present day, he is product specialist for Equitech. Welcome to Now Hear This Entertainment, Joe Salvato.
Thanks very much, Bruce. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yes, sir. Thank you so much for making time out of your busy schedule to speak with me today. I want to start digging into your story. As I said at the start of that intro, you've spent your whole career on the other side of the glass. What originally drew you to the tech side of music rather than performance?
I went to a community college and got my degree in electrical technologies, and that was the beginning of my direction of my career.
Am I to guess that you did not grow up in a household where, you know, parents were performing or siblings where you'd go, well, I see what they're doing?
Not at all. However, music was a preeminent part of our family life because my parents being ballroom dancers from the 40s, music in our family was always around. Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, Ella Fitzgerald, those were the musical names that were always floating around in our house, almost as if they were members of the family.
So then continuing on this question that I had asked at first about what drew you to the tech side of music rather than performance, what is this story about a professor having said to you, you know how to fix tape recorders, right? What were the circumstances of that conversation? How did you respond to him, by the way, and what did that lead to?
Well, I said, of course, yes, and it was because I had brought my open reel tape recorder to a class one time, of which was kind of a unique thing in those days, and he remembered me from that, and he, 2 years after graduation, he called me up and says, you know how to fix tape recorders, right? And I said, sure, not really being the truth, I just went with it. And he said, well, I went on a job interview the other day that I think is perfect for you. I want you to call this guy.
Wow. So what did it lead to? Who was the guy, and did the job pan out?
Well, it was for a guy by the name of Win Schwartau, whose dad was the person that taught Phil Ramone how to engineer back in the 50s.
Whoa.
And he interviewed me, and I didn't know who Phil Ramone was at the time when he said that, but nonetheless, this was the beginning of many, many layered episodes.
You know, I'm interested in the story about him saying to you, you know how to fix tape recorders, right? And then you saying, I actually didn't at the time. I'm looking for a lesson in there for young people aspiring to a career in the music business. But, you know, I have heard people come on this show and say, if someone asks you, can you do something, you just say yes, and then you figure it out later. You sound like someone who's going to agree with that.
Absolutely. I believe that there are many, many different disciplines that you bring to a job. And one of them being knowing how to solder, perhaps, or just have a clue. And I believe if you're intuitive enough, that you will be able to bear fruit from that. And, you know, over my career, that's been my mantra. I've always been able to pull a rabbit out of a hat when I need to. But it's a good thing, because being from the technology side of it, people do expect you to be able to produce something. Never want to say that I haven't had other careers, but this one is the one that took me to my destiny.
But I wonder what you did back then, because nowadays, if someone came and said, you know how to fix insert device here, somebody could say, yeah, of course I do. And when the person walks away, they can go on YouTube, they can text a friend, they can find an online course. Back in your day, those kind of things didn't exist. So how did you go down the rabbit hole of, I need to find out how to fix a tape recorder?
Well, I mean, the degree that I had in electrical technologies gave me a basic understanding of electronics. So when I first went on the job interview with Wynn, he showed me the schematic for a TAC3340S tape recorder, and he opened up the page to the EQ circuit. He says, you know what this is? I says, yeah, that's an EQ circuit. And he says, okay, good. So my instincts were clear, and I had the basic tenets of knowing this is what he was asking me about. Once again, it was an equalizer circuit, but the actual thought of it being inside of a machine was something that was pretty rudimentary. I mean, I kind of got it. And of course, working on the job, once you're there, the tools at hand and those people around you, you just keep your eyes wide open and make sure you only speak when you know it's a good idea. And also good people skills. I think at this moment in time, when we are an embryonic moment of a career, if you really want to be there, you're there, and you're going to know what to do. I think that's a very instinctive thing. And in my career, I've known many interns that I've employed, and you can tell the ones that really want to be there.
Yeah, that's great insight. And audience, it's reminding me of a story that was told on this show back in January, episode 569. I'll put a link to it on the show page for Joe's episode on NHTE.net. My guest then was Chris SD. He goes by, he's a multi-Juno award-winning songwriter and producer. And he told a story about exactly what you're hearing from Joe, which is someone coming to him and saying, you know how to do this, right? And he kind of lied his way through it and then figured out how to do it and impressed none other than, if you can believe it, none other than Blue Rodeo was at the heart of the story. So go back and listen to my interview with Chris SD on episode 569. Joe, let's start getting into some of these cool stories. Take us inside Giant Recording. What was it like to go from designing a studio to owning one and then, oh my gosh, having a legend like Keith Richards around there?
Well, it's kind of the reverse. When we first took occupancy of the space, there was a door that was closed all the time. And then all of a sudden, one day, while we were in the middle of planning the studio and coming and going and becoming a fixture in the building, the door was open. And a young lady who was working there said, oh, hi. And we introduced ourselves. And it became obvious that by all the Stones regalia in the office, that this was not just your average advertising place. And it turned out that it was Keith's office. So it was great because he was very personable when we finally did get to meet them once the studio was built. But think of it. It's kind of like if you built a racetrack next to Mario Andretti's house, you don't think he's going to come around? Because that's exactly what happened. Keith all of a sudden said, oh, a piano. And you know, so, and we became his kind of default lounge many times. And it was wonderful because the studio existed for 13 years, and Keith was there before and after we were finally gone. So he was a fixture. Now, to be around Keith was, I can only describe as, he's a caricature unto himself. He is who you think he would be. And he's delightful, personable, and never standoffish, never one to walk away from a conversation without being very affable. And I had many interactions with him. I took care of his home audio systems. We took care of his guitar amps at the studio over the years. So it was a very, very symbiotic relationship between us. Oh, and we had an ice maker in the studio, which he didn't have, and he was always had a glass in his hand. So, but you know, in the point of fact, he did wind up using the studio for a couple of things. One of them being his record when he was on hiatus with Mick, which was Expensive Winos, which was he and Charlie Drayton, and that record was partially done at Giant Recording over the course of the album. In addition to the fact that Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, which was the 50th anniversary of Chuck Berry's, I think it was his birthday or career, and it was a movie, and we did a lot of the automatic dialogue replacement, and that went on for weeks. And Keith being there all the time, it was just, you know, it's kind of like, it's, you can't believe it. You walk in the room, and there's Keith Richards sitting there, smoking a cigarette at the piano.
Wow. But Giant Recording, though, did you do a full build-out? Was this something else, or was it, no, it was a recording studio already, Bruce. We just kind of updated it and redecorated and put in new gear. What was that building before you made it Giant Recording, or I should say that space?
I think it was a travel agency.
Oh, gosh.
No, we did a complete build-out, and the owner of the studio was a very, very wealthy family that had commissioned us to build this facility close to their home on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, which the studio was located on 57th and Broadway. Under their guidelines and their patronage, the studio became a major boutique recording studio. Now, because I worked in our recording in all the studios that I had worked with up until this point, I kind of knew by reverse engineering what this studio should be. Mm. Now, the owner was a guitar player, and he knew that he wanted to bring his friends around, and the people that he brought around were very, very notable musicians as well. Mm. So we built the studio for a professional audience. This was not a demo studio. It had a 24-track tape recorder, a live room, isolation booths, a client lounge, all within this very, very well thought out layout, which with an architect, their architect, we designed the physical layout, but I did the infrastructure as far as isolation, types of doors that we should use, air conditioning systems, and all the things that a maintenance engineer like myself, I was aware of. I mean, that was my thing. And of course, knowing Phil Ramone, I used him as a sounding block about what he would like the place to have. So he was kind of like my mentor over the years. And this studio in particular was something that I really relied heavily on his nod. You know, he knows everything. And I took a lot of influence from him.
Wow. Fascinating. Friends, the day that this episode is released, I will be at Infocom in Orlando. And I believe I will actually be seeing Joe there, as well as one other past guest from this podcast that I know of. I have not finalized the details yet for July, but I can also tease you with a mention of the fact that it is practically a done deal that I will be somewhere in August, too, for that matter. All this to say, do keep up with the show with the official at Now Hear This Entertainment Instagram account and or the weekly e-newsletter for details on where we might have the chance to meet each other in person, so I can say a face-to-face thank you for listening to this podcast. It means that much to me that you give me close to an hour of your time each week, that I want to extend my gratitude that way if our paths can cross somewhere. Joe, wow. Talk about big names. I had mentioned this in the intro. You were in the room for sessions with Billy Joel, John Lennon, and Frank Sinatra. And for that matter, you've mentioned him a couple times now, but none other than Phil Ramone was your boss when you worked for Billy Joel for 7 years. Feel free to share a cool story about one of those three music legends, but then also, was there one common thread you saw throughout that trio, Joel, Lennon, and Sinatra, that might provide a glimpse into why they were all so successful?
Well, let's talk about Phil, because Phil is the R in A&R Recording Studios, which is where I got my first real big job. Phil was up at that time when I met him, he was producer of the year for Billy Joel's album 52nd Street, so he was on top of the world. And Billy, I think, had won album of the year for that same record. And because of that, he was the star. Now, being the producer and also owning the studio is a very slippery slope for any commercial facility because the owner always wants first dibs. But nonetheless, Phil was a child prodigy violinist. So his musical abilities were very, very broadly honed at that point. And he basically was A&R. He designed and built and implemented this studio to his own delights and likes.
Wow.
Now, Billy was his artist. He and Billy were thick as thieves, and they both together made music. And by that, I mean that most of Billy's work was 70% was written in the studio on the studio clock. He came in with ideas all the time, and depending upon the album and what the genre was, it was the same band for the most part. So they really, really worked together as a unified collection. And even the way we set the drums up, even the way that the eye contact between Phil, Billy, and Liberty, the drummer, was instrumental in the way, to coin a phrase, of how we created these sessions. And the reason is that the session may not have been a continuous session. We may have had to break down because in the morning there might have been a jingle in the studio, and then in the evening it would be Billy Joel. So it was a very rigorous routine for the maintenance department because we were always changing. And for all those that may or may not remember, tape recorders had to be aligned. You just didn't put a file in and just load it. You had to really present the room and calibrate it every time you used it. And that is why the maintenance guy, myself and my fellow maintenance engineers, were so important, because you just couldn't just plug it in and just expect everything to work. You had to be a bit of a engineer, a technical engineer, and that's why I was able to be in the room for these sessions, you know, because I was usually aligning tape machines, presenting microphones that we were hooking up. And in those days, automated consoles were not so plug and play. It was very, very special to do this. I mean, you just, not everybody knew how to do it. And the assistant engineers, the producers, the engineer all relied on my qualification of the room. I said, okay, here's the keys. You guys drive. You know, Phil knew it, and you couldn't do anything that he didn't know already because he was Phil Ramone. So whether it might be the way we patched things or the way we positioned microphones or who was in the room, you know, Billy was the biggest artist I've ever worked with, and up until maybe about the past 5 years, I haven't seen him. But I mean, I can pass him on the street and he'd say, Joe, how are you? We spent a lot of time in the same room together.
And do I have this correct? You were on one of the last sessions that John Lennon did?
Yes. It was an A&R recording studio, A1, which was a very, very large room. And there was a gospel choir that was necessary for the recording. And as a result, they were working primarily at the record plant a few blocks away. And I don't know whether they didn't have time for them or the room, but this particular session with he and Yoko was done at A&R for one evening, just one night. The tapes came over. Yeah, and I believe it was even a 16-track recording, which means that we had to switch the heads on the tape recorder from 24-track to 16-track to accommodate John's session. So it was a real big deal to put this room online, and literally it came in overnight. And that's the thing about working in a major recording studio back then. You didn't know the next day what might have come in overnight and what we were about to do.
Wow. And for Sinatra, it actually was his final session, yes?
It was his final recording, yes. The sessions, I think, went on to a couple more in Los Angeles to be able to do finishing touches on it. But the record's name is L.A. Is My Lady. But it was exclusive, and it was recorded. It's actually a movie. It's called The Making of an Album, and it's on MGM, I think, or MCA. And literally, it went on for 3 days. The first day was getting the film crew set up. It was a 16-man film crew that completely took over the building, every place from the front door into the control room. Then we had a complete orchestra that was set up and rehearsed the day before. The next day, Sinatra shows up. And believe me when I tell you, it's like when this happens, it's like an event. People are just in awe. I mean, you can get, oh, and Quincy Jones was the musical director
Oh,
and
gosh.
conductor. Lionel Hampton was on vibes. George Benson on guitar.
Oh, man.
I mean, no, this was an incredible session. UB Green, Bob Crenshaw, I think is a bass player's name. All these guys all just showed up and everybody dropped everything because it was Sinatra. And so many things happened during this session that we were so responsible for. They set up an entire commissary in one of the other studios for food for everyone. They fed everyone. And I'm in an airlock passing some wires through the airlock to be able to allow the door to close for the film guys wiring. And I hear this voice behind me, "Excuse me, may I get through?" And it's Michael Jackson, followed with a bouncer the size of a refrigerator with Emmanuel Lewis on his shoulder walking through the door. So that's what this is about. And you will see some pictures in the archives of Michael Jackson speaking with Quincy Jones. That was this session.
Oh my gosh.
There was a gallery set up in the live room for about maybe 25 people to sit and listen. It is just an amazing. If you want to watch the video, you'll see LA Is My Lady, The Making of an Album. You can do it on YouTube. And I'm in it, actually. There's a moment I'm kind of in the background. You can see me with my T-shirt on, my Signature Joe T-shirt in the background. But it went on for 72 hours, almost nonstop, to be able to make this happen. A&R Recording was the kind of place that, history is made. And this room was that room. Sinatra actually said during the video, he said he remembers recording in that room back in the 50s.
Oh my gosh. And folks, we're on some kind of run here with all these Michael Jackson mentions. You heard Joe just talk about Michael, and then a few weeks ago on episode 589, CL Turner mentioned him, and I said to CL that Bruce Sudano had told a Michael Jackson story back on episode 585. So the King of Pop, his legacy lives on for sure. Joe, let's start transitioning away from the big names to the present day Joe or Joan aspiring performer. You have said that if one records in a bedroom, it's going to sound like a bedroom. What is the most common mistake you see with home studio setups, and how can artists fix that?
Well, I think it begins in the essential acoustic of a room. I mean, you got to be able to hear. Most of my craft these days has turned to being able to turn the most demure facilities into something that it has a characteristic of a coherent listening environment. And that could mean something as basic as hanging a piano blanket behind your mix position to be able to get rid of the room tone or to fiberglass up a window so you don't hear your neighbor's dog barking. Whatever it is, you need to be able to hear in a coherent fashion. Whether it's a notable producer or somebody that's never done this before, I always find myself in the position of going back and thinking, how can we make this work? And believe me when I say there's a lot of different incantations to make this work. So you got to be able to walk into the room and have some semblance of sound and the acoustical recurrence. That's the first thing. As far as whatever equipment that you use, I can't tell you what you can afford, but we always try to make sure that we give the artist producer enough latitude to be able to make changes in the future. There's so much out there. Because of my Equitech experience recently, been spending some time out at Sweetwater at their campus there, and the level of availability of audio in this today's market, everybody here that's listening to this is so blessed. Because there's so much that you can do with minimal money. And because of that, you can, whatever microphone you choose to buy or whatever interface that you choose to buy, it'll all sound good if you take your time to be able to use it. I also must mention, and this is just a point, that Equitech is a balanced power system, and the kind of power that you bring into your room, everybody's known that when you hear buzzes and hums and clicks and pops, you really don't need that. So if you can ever think about getting your power clean, that's one of the things you should consider because you'll take it with you, like your favorite tube mic, like your favorite interface. Clean power or the ability to hear without distortion, that's something you got to consider also. Small monitors. Everybody uses near field monitors these days, and there's a lot of them. I don't like to do shootouts with things because I'm not the kind of person that spends that kind of quantitative time. I know how to make things sound good. And whatever you choose to do, use it. You know, I mean, whether it's Genelex or Focal or any of the new speakers that are out there that do auto alignments, they're fine. I mean, everybody's, oh, I don't want to use PCM in my speakers. Well, you know what? You may have to. You know, you may have to start out. So for those people that are beginning, do what you need to do to make it sound good. Don't be ashamed or afraid that it's going to sound crappy just because you don't have the kind of studios that people record in all the time. I'm a very essential guy. I've done this for hundreds of times. I've built studios in basements, barns, bedrooms, and they all work coherently. And that's because my experience is what I bring to a client or to an artist. And I love doing that. That's why I'm so happy to do this, because I'm reaching other people that really need to know this. I mean, this is all in my head. I can close my eyes and ears, and I can picture what a room is going to sound like.
Wow.
And by saying that, you can bring somebody into the audio equation. You know what it sounds like. And everybody has worries about what am I doing wrong? Okay, well, there's this thing called a standing wave, and it happens in a room when the bass comes out of the speakers, hits the back wall, and hits you, and all of a sudden it goes away in the mix position. That's a problem. What do? You move your chair. You find a spot in the room where it doesn't happen. See, that's what I'm trying to say. There's always a way to be able to make it work. You don't really have to, you know, have a $50,000 budget. You just have to be able to know how to address the problem.
So, on a related note, then, for those who are trying the DIY route, can you explain what a trin-off is, including whether it is something that can actually make or break a recording?
A trin-off is a active device that actually takes the musical program in real time and allows you to be able to adjust the acoustics of the room, to be able to flatten out the room, to get rid of a bass bump, or to get rid of high frequencies that is floating around. They make all different levels of them. I have a client that has a normal size bedroom that is actually doing an Atmos platform inside of it, and
Whoa.
sitting in his mix position is absolutely stunning because it works so well that your ears belie what you open your eyes and you say, no, that's not possible. But, you know, it's an expensive device into itself, but it does work. You know, now some people, the purists and the audiophiles, will tell you, well, you really are screwing with the audio paradigm by doing this. But once again, form meets function. We really can't say what really you need to do to make something work. But a trin-off is one of those new devices, and it runs on a Linux program, which makes it extremely fast. One thing about them is they get a little warm. Their actual computers inside of it are very, very fast in order to do this function. But it works. Personally, I've only used one, like I'm saying, with this one client once, and it was stellar. I've got to give him a lot of credit.
I am joined today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line from New York City by Joe Salvato, a veteran of more than 40 years in the music industry. Visit his official website at salvatosound.com. I will put a link to it on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. There is contact information on his company website, plus you can also connect with Joe through LinkedIn. You heard him talk about Equitech, and you can find them online at equitech.com. Another online destination that I invite you to check out is buymeacoffee.com/BruceW. That is not a sponsor. There's no brand affiliation. It is actually a platform through which you can do exactly what its name says, which is buy me a coffee or two or five. As a fun way for you to not only send your support, your thanks for the work I put into this podcast, but we can interact with one another there. You will see comments that I post on there responding back to people who have bought me coffees through that site. There is also a shortcut to get there, which is to simply go to my podcast website, nhte.net, and then tap or click on the bright yellow Buy Me a Coffee button. Listeners and even guests have utilized that, and I do appreciate your taking time to look at it.
And Bruce, one of the things I have to say to your listeners, I really love hearing from people that have questions, because in some ways I feel that what is in my head I have to share with people. I'm not a youngster anymore. However, I definitely, the music business keeps me young, and to be able to interact with people and explore what they're doing and be able to help people on the, I mean, look, I make a living, obviously, but that's not what this is about. This is about sharing information. This is about being able to show people that there is a way to make good music, even in your bedroom.
I love it. I love it. Joe, you have seen it all, analog to digital, albums to streaming. How has the shift changed the way that music is recorded? But also, I wonder, is there something you can point to that has not changed?
Well, let's do the first one first. I was around when CDs first came out, and so much so that I was the first person at A&R Recording to bring a CD. It was a Sony Discman. It was a little black box, and this was before all the other major manufacturers were making rack-mounted units. And I walked in with this thing with a mini jack and plugged it into their console, and everybody said, "What just happened here?" But the fact of the matter is that some of the recordings that were being put on CDs early on were actually just clones of the masters from the record labels that were just taking an RIAA recording and committing it to CD. That wasn't good. So one of the things that you didn't mention is that I did work for BMG for 4 years of my life during the time when they were transferring all their masters over to digital domain. And that gave me a very, very great education in what once was and what it became. And yes, the difference between analog to digital is dramatic. But Phil Ramone said to me when listening to, I think it was Star Wars on that same CD player I mentioned, he looks at me and says, "Well, it almost sounds as good as analog." And that's a very interesting response from a Grammy Award-winning producer, because let's face it, it's almost not what you're hearing, it's what you don't hear. It's the sound in between, it's the silences, it's the digital blacks that we're listening to. So yes, I believe that, we've come from the height of analog when I first got into the business to the embryonic stages of digital in the early 80s, and then went on to work with it and became the format of choice, obviously. And I think that all the different variations on that and the rooms that we listen to it are all moments in time. We all know what sounds good. When you walk away from something, a little, once again, excuse me for interjecting with Phil. We once put, he was working on a recording for a movie called Reds. It was a big dramatic scene with a Civil War battle, and the first hit on the movie as the movie fades from black was a cannon fire, but which actually was a timpani. And Phil, we had changed the amplifier. We had a Macintosh 2500 amp that we swapped out the night before, and the marked position on the console was dramatically off. Nobody checked. So everybody jumped out of their chair when it happens, and Phil hits the dim button and stops the recorder and goes, "When you can create fear in the human condition because of reproduced audio, now you know you have something." Right? Now, when you do that, when you can scare the crap out of somebody because of something sounding that good, wow, that's amazing. So let's fast forward ahead to the new renaissance of, or the resurgence of vinyl and back to vinyl. I'm really amazed at how good vinyl sounds these days. I mean, I forgot how good it did sound because now I have a room that I listen to both in all formats, open reel tape, cassettes, vinyl, digital streaming, and everything sounds really good. I will tell you that the 2496 recordings that you're playing back on streaming is truly amazing. They have gone back to the masters, and I feel that there's a real reason for listening in that format. But once again, it depends on the room, it depends on the program, and Phil also told me, Phil says, "Garbage in, garbage out." So, you got to remember these things. When you're trying to be able to listen, and sometimes it's for work, sometimes it's for pleasure, sometimes it's for background. And when you do that, you're training your ears all the time, all the time. And what was the second question? I'm sorry.
Is there something you can point to that has not changed?
Vinyl. I think the vinyl sounds really good on an RIAA, you know, EQ curve that is what all records are built upon these days. It sounds really good. I'm really impressed. And it doesn't have to be 180 gram vinyl. It could be reissues. I just got a Jimi Hendrix compilation of music, not of his original stuff, but of other things that were just recreated off the two-track masters. And the vinyl sounds great. Vinyl is good. I mean it.
It's funny that you're in New York, I'm in Florida, and yet it took both of us having been in Anaheim, California to meet each other back at the end of January. I'm referring to our both having been at the NAMM show. What caught your attention this year, and what gear or trends should indie musicians be watching?
I think look for devices that will allow you to hear more coherently, meaning acoustic devices, meaning panels, or there's this one company that the name escapes me. I think they're from Switzerland, that allows you to be able to put this tubular device in your room and it changes your low frequency response. I think that's something that was completely out of left field that I'd never seen before. There's a tremendous number of reproduced microphones. I think for a couple of $100, we can get microphones these days, whether it be a Warm Audio or a Blue, that sound really good. I mean, everybody craves and yearns for a U67 or an 87. Sure, that's nice. But I believe that the availability, as I said earlier, of being able to purchase equipment that is really pennies on the dollar from what it used to be is something that's very affordable, you know? Other than that, I mean, the NAMM show was really good this year. I really had a good time with it. I think the Universal Audio, their plugins are always going to, you know, blow our socks off. And I think somebody told me that they're having a sale right now, a huge reduction in their purchase price if you buy it as a bundle. These are things that you got to put in your paint box. You know, guys, you know, these things don't go away. I mean, everybody's using plugins. Everybody needs them. And in a matter of full disclosure, I am not a digital engineer. I think I only open Pro Tools sessions to do alignments. I've never recorded in Pro Tools. I've watched and assisted in sessions like that. But my game is analog recording because that's my age. But man, I'll tell you, the guys that really know how to use this equipment can really, really turn a digit.
But let's go back to talking about Equitech, because I want you to clarify what you said earlier. You can take it with you, but then please, just for those that don't know, just explain what balanced power is and why it matters, even in a home studio setup.
Yes. We, in the United States, use electricity out of the wall that is coming out of one side of the outlet. Now, everybody knows there's two holes on the outlet and one hole on the bottom. Equitech is a transformer that, by taking that power out of the wall, it puts it into this transformer, and the other side of the transformer spits it out with 60 volts on either side of the plug with respect to the ground. Now, why is that important? Because every piece of audio equipment you've ever listened to takes the electricity as soon as it gets in a box and turns it to DC. And when it does that, it takes both sides of that 60 volts and allows your equipment to sound much better. There's something called a bridge rectifier that is inherent in all power supplies and in electronic gear. By feeding the electricity to that bridge rectifier in any piece of equipment, be it an amplifier, a console, a microphone, it now allows the audio to sound unbelievably quiet and unbelievably open. What it's defeating is something called common mode rejection. It is the principle by which a bridge rectifier takes the electricity and converts it. And this problem has been around since Marconi. It's not something new, and everybody's always struggled with it. But the thing is no matter what piece of equipment you're listening to, it has a DC power supply built into it. The Equitech device allows the electricity that you feed your gear to be like racing fuel to a Ferrari. You can run your Ferrari on 87 octane, but it sure isn't going to perform like a Ferrari. And that's why now Equitech produces a entry level one for, I think, I'm not the salesperson, but I think it's under $2,000. And you can use this on most speakers, your audio interface, your guitar amplifiers, and it changes the way that your sound happens. Everybody that listens to it says, what just happened here? How come it works? Well, because we've solved the problem. Well, I didn't solve the problem. Martin Glassman, the designer of it, did. He didn't solve the symptoms. He fixed the problem. He gave us power now that feeds your audio gear in a way that it never could do before. Now, you say, well, what about those other companies that build the other equipment? We don't. This is not a competition here. It's just a reality. Everybody knows that Equitech is the name to hit, to the point that some guy asked me a couple of weeks ago. He says, well, what's your return policy? I says, we don't have one. He said, well, what? That's like a sales pitch, right? I said, no, nobody ever returns them because they work. And to be honest, and my wife, who listens to these conversations single-endedly, she says, well, how long does it last? I says, well, forever, because all it is a transformer. It has no active electronic componentry. Wow. It just passes. It's a big inductor. And the power comes in from the wall as dirty, you know, power company power, and spits it out as glorious electricity that all audio gear just loves to use.
Wow. In the first half of the show, we heard about some of the biggest names in music that you had the opportunity to be around. And yet there are actually more. I understand you did work for both 50 Cent and Mariah Carey.
Well, Mariah Carey was doing an installation for her at her home in upstate New York, helping SSL putting a console in, and also working with her at my one of the other studios that I was chief engineer for, which was Right Track Recording. So she was one of the artists that was in the studio. The list goes on. I mean, we worked with Diana Ross, Steely Dan, Peter Tosh, Paul Simon. I mean, I Judy Collins, you know, all these artists that just came my way. And 50 came to me because one of his engineers was working at Right Track and said that they were having some problems at 50 Cent's palatial home in Connecticut. And we repaired and fixed problems that he was having at his studio for years. And he loved it so much that we built a studio for him in Manhattan, which was this beautiful little, like, altalier for him to use in Manhattan. So, yeah, 50 was one of those clients that came to me through his engineering staff. And we were able to build him two really, really great recording studios.
Wow. In the lead up to today, you told me that every day in the studio brought something unexpected. You kind of started to allude to that earlier when you said you wouldn't know what might come in overnight. So how did needing to have that mindset prepare you for working with high-level artists? And for that matter, how can indie musicians apply that same flexibility today?
Well, never get flustered. This is a job. When this happens, you look at it and say, okay, right away you start to think about what can go wrong. Fix the things that are going to go wrong first, or you think can possibly go wrong. Then the things that are going to happen correctly will be piece of cake. And that means know where all of your files are. Do good file management. Try to be able to never come into a situation where you don't know where something is. Nobody wants to wait around for you to be able to fumble through something. Make sure you've checked things. I've had engineers and assistant engineers come in the night before and set up a headphone to make sure that the cue on an orchestral date work. Be prepared. It's a Boy Scout motto, and it's the truth. Don't walk in thinking that it's going to be okay just because you want it to be. It better be because you checked it three times. I've woken up out of a dead sleep thinking of something. I said, oh, man, did I remember that? And that's what you got to do. You've got to be aware. And that's coming, once again, I'm not a creative. I'm not here to be able to tell you what the BPM on something is going to be, or whether or not something's going to fit. I'm here to tell you that your equipment and your creative process begins with the technology.
But it also speaks, Joe, to reputation, because if you are someone that's poor with file management, you're starting to be known as, oh boy, you got your hands full if you're doing a session with that guy, with that gal. You know, if you were there, if Joe Salvato was there, it meant that everything was working. And that's a great reputation to have, as opposed to, whoa, good luck if you're going to be doing a session with so-and-so. He or she is really disorganized, really unprofessional, and so on.
Clearly. You know, some kid at an AES Society symposium asked me, so what is it that you really do? I says, okay, I sit in the shop and I wait for the phone to ring. And as soon as the phone rings and they say, Studio A, I go into Studio A. Now, guys, have you ever noticed that there's always a window on a control room door? Why? Because you're supposed to look inside and see what's going on before you enter the room. The second I go in, the first thing I'm saying, what window are they in? Are they in a mix window? Are they in an edit window? Are they recording? What does a patch bay look like? What am I supposed to do? I'm going to walk into an engineer's studio that he's paying hundreds of dollars an hour, and I've got to fix a problem while there's a client sitting there. The first thing I do is I turn the thermostat down to like 60 as I walk in the room. Literally, that sounds like a funny thing. I cool the room down so cool heads prevail. Then I stand behind the engineer and wait for him to introduce me to what he's experiencing. Those are the kind of things that you innately do. You must be like have the situation in hand before you walk into the room, especially if you're working with an unknown. Now, say you're subbing for somebody, or somebody's invited you to sit in on a session, or you're getting the ability to run tape for somebody, so to speak. Just be aware. Just think about this. You know, I mean, the opportunity to be in a real professional recording environment is a gift. We all know. Do you know that when I first started in the business, there was over 250 major recording studios within a 5-mile area of Midtown Manhattan? And you can get a job. I was able to get a job for somebody in a heartbeat, or as an intern, as a runner, as somebody to make coffee in those days. Not so much now. So when you get to go into one of these hallowed places that we all want to be in, take it very seriously and take notes and do whatever it is that you got to do to make sure that people remember you, whether it's, you know, make nice with the receptionist or talk to the studio manager. This is a business that is coalesced into a very, very rare few. But the fact is when you get there, I mean, I was at East West Recording a couple of months ago when we were at NAMM, as a matter of fact, Bruce, and it was just amazing to walk in that place. And, you know, and these interns were running around like they loved it. You could just see the excitement in their eyes. You know, that's what you want, guys. We want to be in that environment. Everybody that ever wanted to be in the music business knows that a recording studio is the place we all want to be. And for you to present yourself, you know, and by the way, everybody, let's be clear, be presentable. Don't walk in flip-flops. Don't wear a torn t-shirt. Make it look like you care about where you're being. And forgive me showing my age there a little bit, but being the manager and being the chief of maintenance, I know who's the guy I want. And one other last thing about this. Never be afraid to put on a resume what you've done. I've done everything from, I've been a glazer working for my friend's father as a glass cutter. I've been a dog groomer. I've worked on oil burners, and it's gotten me jobs. This kid once came into the studio at Right Track Recording, and he says, the first day of his job, he says, what can I do? I says, go into Studio A. There was a whole session last night. There's a bunch of piano blankets around the piano. Go fold them up and put them in the closet behind the piano. And I walked in later on, and I walked through the room, no blankets. I go in the closet, and I look at the closet, and the blankets, Bruce, from floor to ceiling are stacked up like they were soldiers. I said, let me go find that kid. And I said to him, I said, yo, Peter, whatever his name was, where'd you learn how to fold blankets like that? He says, oh, I worked at the Gap for 2 years. I says, good. Now you're going to go find all the other interns and show them how to fold the blanket. You see, that's a very interesting allegory, but it's the truth.
So cool.
Never be afraid to bring something to a party.
So cool. So cool. This has been great. Joe, final question. You have earned trust from some of the biggest names in music. What is your advice to artists about building relationships with engineers and producers so that they can build lasting creative partnerships?
It's be organized. Be not afraid to carry a guitar with you if you want to. Always be ready. The idea of being able to be in the presence of other people's greatness is you being able to present yourself appropriately. And I think that, you know, in this day and age, there's a lot of information out there. Like you said, Bruce, there's YouTube videos, there's Blackbird Studios, there's all the different facilities that teach higher learning of audio. You know, even if you take it online or whatever, just learn. There's a lot out there, and it's very available. Not like it was when I, like you said, Bruce, when we started this, when I got into this business, this information was strictly word of mouth and, you know, maybe going to school and learning. But there's a lot out there to be able to feed off of and just find out.
I love it. I love it. All good stuff. Joe, fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for making time to be on Now Hear This Entertainment. This was outstanding, as I knew it was going to be.
Thank you very much, Bruce, for having me. And I look forward to hearing from anybody that is listening to your podcast. And we'll have a good time.
My pleasure. My pleasure. And audience, with that, I will wrap up another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment. My sincere thanks to longtime music industry professional Joe Salvato. Again, do visit his company website at salvatosound.com. As I mentioned earlier, I will have a link to it on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. You will see information on there regarding how you can contact him, connect with him as well through LinkedIn, and check out equitech.com as well. That's going to do it for episode 591. I'll talk to you next week on another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment.